great broad boulevard is just a river of humanity now. The automobiles are blocked down as far as the Treasury Department. So is the streetcars. We've had a tremendous scene here because just a few minutes ago, the wife of President Truman came out on the front porch of the White House. There was a tremendous surge of people across the street to answer her as she waved and greeted the crowd. She has since gone inside, but the excitement here is tremendous. There are two rather important items I think that I should give you before returning this. First of all, the president has ordered a two-day holiday for all government employees. That will be... You can gather from the sounds that there are some of them here. That will be for tomorrow and Thursday, and this action is to be without charge against the annual leave of the employees. They're all very pleased about that. The president also has ordered, and on the recommendation of the War Department, that Selective Service shall reduce inductions immediately from 80,000 down to 50,000 a month. This figure will be just enough men to support the forces required for occupational duty. He hopes to bring home 5.5 million men in the next year. The president has now come out on the porch, and the crowd are swarming across the street again, waving at him. He is up on the porch, waving at the audience. They are all, it's a little difficult to see from here because the big fountain cuts off our view, but this is a perfectly magnificent scene. I wish I could give you more detail, but I return you now to CBS in New York.
Back again in New York, at Columbia's news headquarters, Bob Trout speaking, and as our correspondent Bill Henry was talking to you from the White House, we've been told here in our news headquarters that a great change has come over the city of New York, too. All the pent-up emotion, which gave way in some people during the last few days of long, suspenseful waiting, but was held in check in the majority of the population. All that pent-up feeling is now beginning to break loose, and no wonder. The second and last great member of the Axis, the last great enemy of the United Nations, defeated. President Truman out on the porch of the White House greeting the crowds, as you heard. Perhaps I should bring you up to date a little bit, just in case you might, after having stayed with us so long, have not come in promptly at 7 o'clock Eastern wartime to our broadcast. We've been going on here for hours and hours and hours, but at 7 o'clock, just 19 minutes ago, it finally happened. President Truman gave the word to a news conference to the reporters at the White House. Prime Minister Attlee of Great Britain went on the air. It's official, it's complete, it's sweeping. There are no qualifications. The Japanese fully accept the surrender terms of the United Nations. I would like to tell you that the president himself has not been on the air, nor has he actually given the proclamation which will set VJ Day. The president has given a news conference announcing this great victory news, but he has not yet issued his VJ Day proclamation, nor has he broadcast. We heard the broadcast of Prime Minister Clement Attlee of Great Britain. Columbia Shortwave Listening Station in San Francisco just tells us that Tokyo Radio, in a special broadcast, says that Emperor Hirohito personally will read an imperial race script over the radio at 11 p.m. Eastern wartime. Well, we have quite a while to go for that, but undoubtedly we'll all be here until at least 11 o'clock and way beyond it. 11 o'clock Eastern wartime, the Emperor is expected to go on the Japanese radio in person and read the admission of total crushing defeat for Japan. And also, of course, it's a defeat which does bring out, I think we're all thinking right now, does bring out the fact that the decision to go after Germany first will certainly go down in history as one of the greatest military decisions of all time. The Japanese war, it can now be seen so clearly, was merely an appendage of Germany's war, and when the Germans were finished, the Japanese were finished almost automatically. And the boys who struggled and fought across the blue wastes of the Pacific Ocean from island to island did not have to fight their way into the Japanese home islands themselves, as they would have had to do if Japan had been first on the schedule. Germany would not have gone down so quickly, just a few days, more than 3 months after the defeat of her Axis partner, if Japan had been the first to collapse. But Germany collapsed and Japan fell almost of her own weight. Of course, the Russians entered the war. Of course, the atomic bomb was dropped. And I don't mean to disparage any of the great military developments or the fighting qualities and the fighting achievements of all the Allied soldiers, sailors, and airmen in the Pacific. But it can be seen that Japan depended for her mad adventure entirely upon Germany. President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Winston Churchill decided to fight Germany first and Japan afterward, and their decision will certainly rank as one of the greatest, one of the most momentous military decisions ever taken in the history of the world. Our correspondents in the Pacific Islands are listening to our news. We know that Guam has been listening to us because I just had word that the first news flashed on the naval base, the island of Guam, was this, quote, CBS says it's official. CBS now says it's official, end of the quotation. That was the signal, I should imagine, for some very intensive celebrating. At any rate, this is the time to find out what is going on the island of Guam. Our correspondents are standing by. I believe Webley Edwards will be the first to speak to us from Guam. So we switch you now to Guam. After a few seconds pause, well, I'll pause right now on the introduction. I'm not quite sure whether the switch is made ready. Ah, I see. I'm sorry. I'm about 2 minutes early. Guam will be up at 7:24 Eastern Wartime. It's just 7:22 Eastern Wartime. I didn't see the figures there. Well, the first news flash from Guam, as I said, was that CBS says it's official, and that was the signal for Guam to go into its celebration. I think before 7:24, when we do switch, we've time now for a few words from the celebrating center of New York, from Times Square. So we switch you to Times Square. Charles Shaw reporting.
A balcony of the Astor Hotel overlooking Times Square. This is Charles Shaw broadcasting from a balcony of the Astor Hotel overlooking Times Square. This scene here is almost impossible to describe. I have been told that there are at least 300,000 people massed here from 42nd to 49th Street in Times Square here. It's really, everybody here is just rejoicing at the news that the war is over. Quite a few naval officers are here, and that's probably the noise, the immediate noise you hear in the background. And people are milling around here now. They were rejoicing when they saw the signs of the on the New York Times news bulletin, the electric bulletin there, which told them that the Japanese surrender had been received. But however, the first news which greeted the Times Square celebrators came from a commercial sign here on Times Square, which said Japan surrenders, and then they flashed the V sign, and we were standing here, and we pointed to the crowd to look over to the sign there. And they all, everybody cheered very, very happily.
Back again at Columbia's headquarters in New York. Guam is ready now, so without further ado, we take you to Guam. Webley Edwards reporting.
Even after all the false ones, the official word came as a quick thrill. Early morning here, we've been celebrating in a semi-official way all night. Guam is definitely along with you in celebration of the end of the war. I just talked with a U.S. Army Signal Corps man named Eugene Cohen of Brooklyn, and he said, well, it may be over, but I still have to sweat it out going home. I hope I get home to Brooklyn soon. So now we've heard it's official. So now the last of the renegades gives up. Japan has found that the way of the transgressor is hard, that the wages of sin is death, that he who lusts for his neighbor's possessions must meet his eventual punishment, as the aggressor who makes war meets his end in war. Yes, old, well-worn phrases those. But in this hour, they seem like comfortable thoughts to tie to. In a little while, the wild rejoicing and the bright shouts will begin. We will pound one another on the back. We will throw our hats in the air. Some will get drunk, and some will want to laugh and sing and cry all at once for sheer relief. But right now, this is the hour we've been waiting for out here ever since the morning of December 7th, 1941. Like the soldier who has just finished a grueling battle and lays down and falls asleep on his arms, a reaction of unutterable weariness comes upon us. I remember that morning at Pearl Harbor like it was yesterday. I remember the blackness in our hearts as the bombs fell and the Jap planes roared down the highways and strafed automobiles to pile them up in broken heaps. I remember the smugness and cockiness of the enemy. He had been pretty smart, all right. He had caught us napping. He struck with a sneak blow. He hurt us bad. We hadn't been ready. He found that out all through the Pacific as he spread out south and east and as far south as New Guinea and as far east as the Gilberts and Kiska and Attu. And I remember the heartbreaking job that stretched out like some painful obstacle race before our leaders and the men who were to go with them. And I remember the weary, dreary early days of the war when we knew we didn't have quite enough. But with that not quite enough, we had to do it anyway. Then the fight back across the Pacific, while priority was given, and wisely we see now, to the war in Europe. Back across the mountains of New Guinea and up its coast and early carrier strikes at the outer fringe of Jap Islands, and the Solomons, Guadalcanal, Tulagi in Florida, and the rest. Then one day, Tarawa on the spearhead in the outer armor of Japan. The big push was on. We're out here now in the Marianas, where we finally came in and occupied a base. We're close by Okinawa and Iwo Jima, from whence we sent this death to the Japs and finally forced them out. Well, that's the way it is here now. We're thinking about those hard days, and just a moment, we'll start celebrating. This is Webley Edwards, that's Guam.
Well, now we're back in San Francisco and ready to hear from another CBS Pacific correspondent. For the reaction to victory from General MacArthur's South Pacific headquarters, Columbia takes you direct to Manila, John Adams reporting.
The official news that Japan is willing to surrender unconditionally has finally reached Manila. Manila's not in a celebrating mood. The celebration started Friday evening about 9 p.m. Manila time when the first Tokyo peace proposal was announced to the world. With each new flight of the slow diplomatic peace pigeon between Washington, Bern, and Tokyo and return, there were new flurries of excitement. Street parades, boisterous parties, and early morning headaches. Climaxed by the short-lived jubilee yesterday afternoon when Domei placed the Tokyo decision to accept the Potsdam Proclamation. Rain, which is still falling, helped subdue part of the celebration. But most of the boys seem to feel that they have their biggest celebration yet to come when they hit San Francisco or any other U.S. port and the war will be over for keeps. Although it appears that the negotiations for peace have now been concluded between Japan and the Big Four through the slow, tightly coded official and diplomatic channel, it will still be some time before we get Japan on the dotted line. We still have no inkling here at General MacArthur's headquarters just where and when that will be, and who may be the Allied Supreme Commander that was mentioned in Secretary Burns' first counter-proposal. A few minutes before the official news was released over the radio by President Truman and Prime Minister Attlee, I phoned General MacArthur's quarters and told them CBS had tipped me off to stand by for an important announcement. One of his military aides was still a bit dubious, but said he would pass on the message to the general. The general was having breakfast. It is now 8:20 a.m. Wednesday, August the 15th in Manila, and it was the first information they had that the official announcement would be made shortly. General George Kenney, MacArthur's air chief and commander of the Far East Air Forces, was less cautious when I phoned him of our alert and said in a rather tired voice, "I guess this is really it. The Japs are done." I asked General Kenney his plan, and he replied, "That depends on the commander-in-chief, but you'll see me in Tokyo shortly." This is John Adams in Manila. I return you to CBS.
Back at Columbia's news headquarters in New York, Bob Trout speaking. Before we continue with our great victory broadcast, we're going to pause for 30 seconds for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. Columbia's news headquarters in New York, Bob Trout speaking. Just before we paused 30 seconds for the station identifications from coast to coast, we were listening to our correspondent in Manila, John Adams, who told us that out in the Philippine Islands, they still do not know who will be the supreme allied commander in the Pacific area. But all the news associations here in New York have carried the story that General MacArthur is to be appointed as the supreme allied commander in the Pacific War Theater. We broadcast that news about 2 minutes after seven, I believe, very quickly after the original announcement that the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain have announced that Japan accepts the surrender terms of the United Nations and accepts them with no qualifications, fully, absolutely, and completely. Japan is finished, but the surrender has not yet been signed. Now, we've heard from Washington several times. We've heard from our correspondent, Bill Henry, in the White House, and now we're going to try another point in Washington. I'm not sure exactly what the point is, as a matter of fact, because our correspondent is in the CBS mobile transmitter in Washington, and he might be on almost any street in our nation's capital.
A fresh summer evening breeze. In the midst of all this pandemonium, men and women thrust their heads out of the building's windows and shouted, "It's over, it's over, the war is over." At the crowds down in the street and at neighbors to whom they might never have spoken before, because New York is like that, but who may have been living across the court or a few days away from them for the past 20 years. At the same time, just a few minutes after this tremendous spontaneous outburst of cheering and hooting and kissing in the streets had started, those thousands of radios in those buildings simultaneously began to blare out the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. And hundreds of the radios were turned up to their loudest so they could blast out that grand old tune that never sounded better to American ears than it did here just an hour ago. And that's how America's biggest city first reacted to the news, in a spontaneous outpouring of rejoicing that will never be forgotten by those who saw it. Now back to Bob Trout.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special announcement. We have an announcement from the First Methodist Church of Kalamazoo that a service will be held this evening at 8 o'clock. This announcement is made by the Reverend Dwight S. Large. We also have an announcement from the First Baptist Church of Kalamazoo, from Dr. T. Thomas Wiley, the pastor of that church, that a service will be held at the First Baptist Church in Kalamazoo at 7:30 this evening. We rejoin CBS.
Must be informed by the Japanese of the effective date and hour for the hostilities to stop. Second, that the Japanese government send emissaries immediately to General MacArthur with information on the Japanese forces and with full power to make arrangements as General MacArthur directs for the formal enemy surrender, which of course has not yet come. Third, that the Japanese government stand ready to receive from General MacArthur information on the time, place, and other details of the formal surrender. The text of this message by the President was released by the State Department about half an hour after it was placed in the hands of the Swiss Chargé d'Affaires, Max Dressley, who's been acting as the intermediary in the exchange of notes, which began last Friday morning when the Japanese government sent the note telling the governments of the four principal allied nations united in the war against Japan that the Japanese were prepared to surrender under the terms of the Potsdam Declaration, and they wanted to know about the emperor and the emperor's prerogatives. They were told on Saturday. They claimed they heard only on Monday what the Potsdam ultimatum would mean for the emperor's future, and of course today they have announced that they will surrender unconditionally. There are no reservations in the note. That's the announcement that the President of the United States made less than an hour ago. It seems like many hours ago. These past 53 minutes have been so crowded. And Prime Minister Attlee of Great Britain went on the air. We brought you his words, too, as he told the people of Great Britain that the last great fascist enemy, the last member of the Axis, is now completely and thoroughly defeated. Japan is beaten to her knees. The Moscow home radio announced at the same time, 7 p.m. Eastern wartime, that Japan had sent the note accepting the Allied surrender terms. This broadcast was heard by the Federal Communications Commission, and of course it wouldn't be noteworthy particularly because we know that the surrender note is in the hands of the Allied governments, but the Moscow radio has been very cautious and has not been telling the Russian people very much about the tense weekend which the people of many other Allied countries have had as the interchange of information went on between the Allied governments and the Japanese government. Moscow radio had said very little about it, and the Russian people, perhaps, I don't really know, but perhaps they had not quite realized how near the total defeat of Japan was. Tonight they were told that Japan is surrendering. They were told at the same time, and this time, the arrangements for the release of the news did work, as we can see. It must have been announced simultaneously in all four Allied capitals. I hope it was. We haven't heard from China, but we do know, upon receipt of this news from Russia, that the Russians, too, announced it at the same hour, at the same moment. And that's one time, at least, when the arrangements for simultaneous announcement and release of news do seem to work. Earlier, the Moscow radio said that the Soviet Union and the Chinese Republic had signed a treaty of friendship today, and that, of course, is extremely important for the days which will immediately follow the formal surrender, which has not yet been carried out. It has been agreed to, but it has not been carried out. King George is going to broadcast tomorrow at 4 o'clock Eastern wartime. That information has just come in. We expected that the King would broadcast. We did not know the time, and now the time has been set. 4 o'clock Eastern wartime tomorrow, King George will broadcast. The Moscow radio said today that Emperor Hirohito had ordered all Japanese armed forces, wherever they are, to cease military operations, to give up their arms, and to follow the orders of the Supreme Allied Commander. And the Tokyo radio came on in a special broadcast to say that Emperor Hirohito personally would read the Imperial Order over the radio at 11 p.m. Eastern wartime tonight. I don't know how well we're going to be able to get the Emperor's words, and we can't tell whether the Japanese really are going to broadcast what they say they're going to broadcast. If you were listening through the hours of last night with us, you'll know exactly why I say that. But if the Emperor really does go on at 11 o'clock, and if many people in the Allied world can hear the Emperor, it certainly would be a broadcast worth listening to. Well, then again, perhaps it wouldn't. I'm not sure. At any rate, the war is over. The Second World War is over. President Truman announced it at 7 o'clock, and I'm just repeating it for you because it just is possible that although we've been broadcasting for so many hours here, perhaps you just might have tuned in a bit late. And so I better tell you again that the note finally did come from the Japanese government to Switzerland. It was delivered through the normal diplomatic channels to Washington, just as the President's Secretary, Charles Ross, had seemed confident that it would be during the long weekend vigil. It was delivered this evening around 6 o'clock. Shortly after 6 o'clock, the Swiss chargé d'affaires took the note to Secretary of State Burns. Secretary Burns took it to the White House. The President called a news conference promptly at 7. Just a few moments later, it seemed, the correspondents burst out of the President's room, and we had the news almost instantly. And shortly after that, Prime Minister Attlee was on the air telling the British people and also our Columbia audience that the war is over. That is, the Japanese have surrendered to the United Nations and have accepted the United Nations terms. They make no reservations about these terms. They accept them, but of course they have not carried out the formal surrender. And we're not sure. We hope, but we're not sure that the surrender will be carried out, the formal signing, and also the very difficult business of rounding up the huge and almost undefeated Japanese armies in some parts of Asia. We're not sure that all that great task can be carried out with no hitch and no untoward circumstances. Well, this is Bob Trout at Columbia's news headquarters in New York. I've been bringing you up to date as well as I can on some of the things that have been happening in this very crowded hour, which still lacks 3 minutes of being a complete hour, starting with the great moment of 7 p.m. Eastern wartime. I've just been informed that we can hear, though, what's going on in another part of New York, a part that is considerably noisier than our news studio here. So let's see or hear what's going on here in another part of New York. We take you to the CBS mobile transmitter, Larry Lesser reporting.
New York has been liberated. We're going simply wild down here at 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. But this is an automobile celebration down here at 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. The cars are speeding fast in a mad dash. Just hear those horns. People are hanging onto them too deep, really just clinging to the sides of the cars. The horns are wide open. Their precious batteries may be running down, but they don't care. All the office workers have gone home from this great industrial region, and they're probably celebrating in the great suburbs of New York, in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens. And the streets down here are filled with holiday makers. And there are trucks from all over New York loaded down with bands and youngsters. Just hear them blowing those horns. These speeding cars can hardly stop for the red light. They're equipped with bells, with Halloween horns. This is greatest celebration I've ever seen. Greater than the liberation of Paris, I think. But the churches are filling up, too. Sophisticated New York isn't so blasé as they say. St. Patrick's Cathedral is filling up with people when I came past. Everyone is walking somewhere in every direction. They don't seem to care where they're going, but all they want to do is keep moving. But more than anything else, this is an automobile parade down here, 5th Avenue and 42nd Street. There's no trouble with the crowds. They're all surging forward, probably going over to Times Square or uptown. They're shouting from the tops of the buses. People are shaking hands. People are kissing. People are embracing. This is New York at the end of the Second World War, in a frenzy of excitement, wild with joy, expressing their pent-up relief, enthusiasm, and getting rid of their wartime inhibitions. This is Ira Lasser returning you now to Columbia News Headquarters in New York.
Back again in our news headquarters in New York. I think it's just about time to pause briefly for station identification. We have not had a station identification for some time, so I just want to tell our stations across the country that that's what we're getting ready to do right now. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You're listening to station WKZO on the Burdick Hotel, Kalamazoo. Here are a couple of other local announcements. By order of the city manager, the city hall of the city of Kalamazoo will be closed tomorrow. The Calvary Church announces a service at 7:30 this evening. The Free Methodist Church, 511 Jasper Street, announces a service at 7:30 this evening. The Twin Lake Reformed Church announces a service at 8 o'clock tonight. Bulletin, Washington. President Truman has ordered the Japanese to stop fighting on all fronts. The president sent his order through Secretary of State Burns to the Japanese government. And now we're going to take you for a very few moments down to the corner of Michigan Avenue and Burdick Street, where Bob Kamens and Harold Fitzgerald are standing by to bring you a picture of what's going on in downtown Kalamazoo. We're going to stay down there just a few minutes and then return you to the wires of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Take it away, Bob and Harold.
Hello again, everybody. Hello. It's Bob Kamens speaking in downtown Kalamazoo. Harold Fitzgerald and I are still trying to keep our bearings here. I've been told that I was a bit jumpy. Well, believe me, I am, if I sound that way. People are crowding around us. Excitement is going around. Some young fella here is blowing what appears to be a horn. Some confetti was just dropped upon me. The crowd is getting much thicker and much more excitable. Everything is going on here to suggest that the entire city of Kalamazoo is cooped up in the center of the city at Michigan and Burdick, all yelling and all excited. We're going to try to get a few more people here and talk to them. Marion Stutz is halfway up a telephone pole looking at some of the
you
people.
You sound awful corny.
Somebody said we sound awful corny. Well, maybe we do, fella, but after all, this is BJ Day. We're handing it up to Marion now. Take it away, Marion.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking to you down here from a light post about 4 feet above the street here on Michigan and Burdick. The street, as far as I can see down here on Burdick Street, is lined solid with people. Some of the crowds are milling right around the main traffic signal here, right at the corner of Michigan and Burdick, but the police are attempting with great difficulty to keep control of things and keep the traffic moving along. I see people here milling up and down, some snake chains of young people who are celebrating madly through the streets, police attempting to break up the chains so traffic can continue to move, and occasionally when the lights change, the traffic does move, but at a very slow pace. Well, I'll turn it down here to Bob Kamens and to Harold Fitzgerald again. I guess that's about all I can see. Okay, take it away, fellas.
I got a hold of it, but Lord, I don't know what's going to happen now. We're right in the middle of a crowd here, trying to get some semblance of order out of something that can't possibly be orderly. I don't know what Marion said. He was up high on a telephone pole trying to view the center of town. Every once in a while, this microphone slips away from me as I try to look around me. Here's a soldier. Fellow, what do you think?
Wonderful.
Wonderful. What's your name?
Bernard Brown.
What is it?
Brown.
Brown, are you from Kalamazoo?
No, from Chicago.
From Chicago. What are you doing in Kalamazoo?
I'm out at the hospital, Percy Jones Hospital.
Out of Percy Jones Hospital. Have you seen service, sir?
4.5 years.
4.5 years. Now, where did you see service?
England, Germany, Ireland, Luxembourg, Belgium, all over here.
All over, eh?
And Africa.
I see. Well, how are you doing at Percy Jones? You come along okay?
Fine, just fine.
And would you expect to be out soon?
By next week, I hope.
By next week, and you're going to get a discharge now.
A medical discharge.
Medical discharge. Well, congratulations, sir. You've done
Thank
a wonderful
you.
Job to ensure their
Thank
victory.
Thank you, before I get drowned.
Yeah. By drowned, he means with paper. Paper is flying around here. Streamers are coming in every once in a while. If a half a part of it goes down my throat, I may have to choke out around here. All right, Harold, you better wait. I'll wipe these things off the microphone here and hand it back to Harold Fitzgerald.
Well, believe me, I've seen everything now. This crowd around here is certainly pushing and throwing confetti so that I'll be wiping it out of my head and ears for a week, I believe. Let's see. Here's the lady. What's your name?
Martina Drake.
And where do you live?
714 North Edwards.
Well, you certainly look happy.
Oh, I am.
Any reason?
Oh, I sure am. My guy's home from coming home.
Oh, your guy's coming home. Where is he?
Well, the last I heard, he was in France.
Right over in France.
Yes,
the last
sir.
You heard. Well, it will mean that he'll be coming home. You believe you may. Who is this lady next to you?
Aliva Land.
And where do you live?
1842 South Park.
Any special effects this day has
well,
on you?
Well, you're not only kidding. He'll be home soon, I hope.
Where is he? Your husband?
No, boyfriend.
Boyfriend, where is he?
He's over in Washington right now.
In Washington.
That's right.
Well, he just got a short hop, hasn't he?
That's right. Sooner the better.
Thanks a lot, ladies. There goes some more confetti.
Yeah, lady, Dr. Fitzgerald.
You got a lady?
Here's a lady right here, Harold, whose face is just all smiles, just beaming with happiness. What's your name, madam?
Ruth Simpson.
Ruth Simpson, Miss or Mrs.?
Mrs.
Mrs. Simpson. Are you from Kalamazoo?
Yes, I am.
And why particularly do you have such a broad smile?
Well, my husband's the lead party to come home.
England. From England. He's coming home.
He was in the D-Day invasion and on through all the way through.
And had he expected to have to go to the Pacific?
Yes, he did.
And now we
now
hope
he won't
you'll...
have to.
Now he won't have to. How long has it been since you've seen him?
16 months,
I see. And just exactly where did this D-Day, or rather, this VJ Day find you? What were you doing when the flash came over?
I was swing porch.
On the swing porch?
No, out in the kitchen.
Out in the kitchen. What was your first reaction? What'd you do?
I think I kind of started to cry.
You started to cry. Well, cry with happiness, I'm sure. Thank you very kindly. I'm sure we all share in your happiness for your husband coming home. There's a lady who really appreciates VJ Day, Harold. Her husband was going to come home and then go to the Pacific. Now we hope he'll be home for keep.
Well, we all hope that, Bob. I think this really does it all the way around. And we can't help but stop and think, ladies and gentlemen, that this day does have a real meaning, not only from the standpoint of joy, but also for thanksgiving and prayer.